From the gorgeous confines of Melbourne, Australia, across the USA and 61 countries spanning the globe, Expat Progressive Radio presents The Bill Show with Bill and Randall. Now fasten your seatbelts, kids, because here are the loudest fat lefties on the net, Bill and Randy.
And welcome to the Bill Show, ladies and gentlemen. This is show number 134, and we're probably going to have a less jovial show than we have. We are going to be talking to our good friend Randall Berger from Long Beach, California, through the miracle of FaceTime later on in the broadcast. But today, of course, the world has been reeling over the past 2 weeks from the terrible, terrible act of violence perpetrated in France, in Paris, and surrounding areas. Brussels is still in lockdown. And over the past 2 weeks, you've been listening, I'm sure, over to the media, on the media, and in all different ways. The media is all over this like flies on rice, and talking basically about how do we defeat ISIS? How do we stop ourselves from being victims of this kind of terrible, terrible violence in the future? And is there an answer? Well, we're going to do a little investigation of that and talk a little bit about the history of the situation, but also what can be done or what hasn't been done to defeat ISIS or to contain ISIS. First of all, I'd like to direct you to a clip that I thought was one of the most informative clips in the last week. And that was from a Colonel Jack Jacobs, who is a Medal of Honor winner, and had an interview with Stephen Colbert on The Late Show. And I'd love you to have a listen to it. I've got the clip right here. Let's have a listen to this, and we'll be back in just a minute. Have a listen to Colonel Jack Jacobs from Stephen Colbert.
So it seems like all the great powers say there has to be military action against ISIS on a greater scale. What has happened so far in response to the attacks in Paris?
Well, actually, not a lot. I mean, there are a few more airstrikes. Everybody's decided that something has to be done. But at the end of the day, really nothing significant will be done because it's not possible to knock these guys out unless we're willing to commit a large number of troops
on
the ground.
How many troops do we have to put on the ground?
Several hundreds of thousands. And for a long time, this is time sensitive, too. It'll take a decade, two decades. I mean, we're not going to do it, and we can't get the people in the region to do it, even though they have an interest in making sure these
Why can't? Okay, so if it's several hundred thousand people, obviously it seems like a coalition would be the answer there, so not one country, because so many countries have an interest, and so many countries have been attacked by ISIS at this point. Why don't the regional powers there want to do anything about it? Why not Saudi Arabia? Why not Iran?
They're at each other's throats. Saudi Arabia and Iran are duking it out for domination and influence in the area, so they're not going to coalesce into anything. As a matter of fact, if you throw Turkey into the mix, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Iran, very powerful armed forces, very, very good air forces. So right now, who's bombing Raqqa? The United States and France. There's an argument that says we ought to just shut up and forget about trying to unseat despotic, bloodthirsty despots because in the past, they've kept the place together.
Well, we certainly were in bed with a lot of bloodthirsty despots for a while, and then we got out of that business and overthrew Saddam Hussein. Would ISIS exist if Saddam was still in power?
I think not. I think it's an outgrowth of that. These are Sunni apocalyptic people who are not waiting for the end of the world. They're hurtling toward it, and they want to bring everybody with them.
So if you had control of our armed forces and our strategy, what should the United States be doing right now to try to destroy ISIS? Because one of the things about this, they have nothing to negotiate, right? They're not looking for anything from us.
No, everything is non-negotiable. They want you to die, and they want to die themselves. It's just a matter of time.
So how do we give that to them?
Well, it, we can do it. Well, there are a couple of things to consider here. The first is you're not going to be able to do it by dropping conventional bombs on people. Mm-hmm. Militarily, the only purpose for bombs is to pave the way for people on the ground to seize and hold terrain long enough to create an environment in which there can be a real government to take out the trash and do all the rest. And we're not doing it, and it takes 250,000 people to do it, probably what, just in Syria.
Any good news, Colonel?
Well, I stayed at a Holiday Inn last night.
Yeah, stayed at a Holiday Inn last night. Very good laugh line, but probably one of the most depressing interviews that I've heard in a long time. When we're talking about ISIS, and by the way, since this, of course, we've had the shooting down of a Russian plane in Turkish airspace, or so it was claimed. So we are starting down that track of basically major powers entering that theater of war and rubbing up against each other, which is a profoundly dangerous situation. And of course, exactly what ISIS wants. If we're looking at what we can do about ISIS, I have a few suggestions, just humbly. The show has a few suggestions. Number one, we need to go after the money. This is off the Atlantic Monthly, okay? We have got to cut off Saudi Arabia until they crack down on extremists. And why Saudi Arabia? Something that we have known for years, ladies and gentlemen, is that Saudi Arabia is the largest source of funds for Islamist militant groups such as Afghan Taliban and terrorist groups. The Saudi Arabian government is also quite reluctant to stem the flow of money. Now, there was during Clinton's State Department, Hillary Clinton said this. She said, more needs to be done since Saudi Arabia remains a critical financial support base for al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and LET and other terrorist groups. This is off a 2009 paper signed by the U.S. Secretary of State. Now, her memo urged that U.S. diplomats redouble their efforts to stop Gulf money from reaching extremists in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Donors in Saudi Arabia constitute the significant source of funding to Sunni terrorists. And that's what we're dealing with right now. We're dealing with Sunni, radicalized Sunni terrorists. And the number one financier of radical Sunnis come from Arabian countries such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates. Now, we have had a deal with the devil with Saudi Arabia since the end of World War II, when Roosevelt said, listen, we will entrench the Saudi family in power as long as we can guarantee oil to the United States. And that has been the contract we've signed in blood with one of the most despotic regimes in the Middle East. And now if you look at the things that ISIS does, and you look at the things that Saudi Arabia has done, you're looking at a lot of the same things. Because they have nurtured the extreme organizations in their country. And they have people who are stoned. They have people who get their heads cut off in the town square. This has been going on, you know, inside a country that is our ally. We have got to start dealing with the huge elephant in the room, and that is the continuing funding of terrorism by Saudi Arabia, which proclaims to be an ally of the United States. We can stop using terrorism to topple unfriendly governments. Now, before you sit there and go, hey, Bill, that doesn't happen. Yes, it does. The origins of this problem come directly from American involvement in the Mideast. The gestation of ISIS can directly be traced back to the Bush administration's invasion into Iraq. But let's look at history. The director of the National Security Agency under Ronald Reagan, a guy named General William Odom, recently remarked, by any measure, the U.S. has long used terrorism. We have used terrorism. In 1978 and 79, the Senate was trying to pass a law against international terrorism. In every version they produced, the lawyers said the U.S. would be in violation. During the 1970s, the CIA was used to prop up the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt as a barrier, both to thwart the Soviet expansion into the Mideast, but to prevent the spread of Marxist ideology among Arab masses. The United States also openly supported Saraket Islam against Sukarno in Indonesia, in our neck of the woods. We supported the Jamaat-e-Islami terror group against Bhutto and Pakistan. And last but certainly not least, we created and funded Al-Qaeda. That's right, we did it. Let's not forget, the CIA gave birth to Osama bin Laden and breastfed his organization during the 1980s. Former British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook told the UN, the House of Commons in England, that Al-Qaeda was unquestionably a product of Western intelligence agencies. Mr. Cook explained that Al-Qaeda, which literally means an abbreviation, this is what it means. It means the abbreviation of the database in Arabic, was originally the computer database of thousands of Islamic extremists who were trained by the CIA and funded by your best friends in that area, the Saudis, in order to defeat the Russians in Afghanistan. Now, America's relationship with Al-Qaeda has always been a love-hate affair, depending on whether a particular Al-Qaeda terrorist group in a given region furthers American interests or not. The U.S. State Department either funds or aggressively targets terrorist groups, not based on the fact of whether they're immoral or not, not based whether they use terror techniques against the population, but does it forward American foreign policy? Which leads us to one of the stupidest comments that I've been hearing. And this is really stupid. And I lifted this from Bill Maher. So this is the comment that's been driving me crazy over the past 2 weeks.
And I'm going to ask you this question that people asked after 9/11, because I don't think we still know the answer. Why do they hate us?
Usually I credit Bill Maher with being a very intelligent guy, so I don't understand that line of questioning. It is complete. It shows a complete lack of memory. Nearly 500,000 people have died from war-related causes in Iraq since the U.S. invasion in 2003. 500,000. How dare we actually, with a straight face, sit there and say, why do they hate us? We invaded Iraq on a lie. George Bush, who should be in jail, and Dick Cheney sold that to America on a lie. We went in there, the media played cheerleader on this, and we went into Iraq in 2003 with no evidence that they had done anything like develop weapons of mass destruction. No evidence was found. And then when we invaded, we put a guy in charge there called Paul Bremer. Now, many of you who are more informed would know who Paul Bremer is. Paul Bremer had the bright idea that he was going to fire every single Sunni. Now, there are the dominant sects, of course, in Iraq, Sunni, Shiite, and Kurd. The only reason these people haven't been at each other is because Saddam Hussein was mean, terrible, awful dictator, but he kept everybody in place. When we went into Iraq, We fired every single Sunni from any position of responsibility. We fired them from the no pensions, no health care, nothing. We took every single person who was responsible for making the trains run on time for anything, and we fired each and every one of them. And here's the kicker. Paul Bremer, this genius, then put into power a Shiite minority that progressed to ethnically cleanse Iraq of the Sunni minority. Do not ever say, why do they hate us? And all I say to you right now is, think if that happened to Americans. Think of Canada. Think of another country came into America, killed 500,000 Americans in a completely trumped up war with absolutely no reason to actually invade. There's a good reason the people in Iraq hate the United States. It is increasingly obvious that for us to understand how to deal with the problem of ISIS, we must not make the same mistakes again. And for us to look very carefully at history. We'll be back after this message.
I'm supporting the UNHCR's appeal for the refugee crisis in Europe. I'm doing this in honor of Hulud, a Syrian woman I met whilst I was in Lebanon. Hulud was an architect back in Syria. She was an educated, successful, professional woman. Hulud had no reason at all to leave Syria except to run from war, with her children, leaving everything behind. As a mother, I can only imagine the difficulty and distress of making such a decision. Hulud told me she felt there was no option left to her but to make the dangerous sea passage to Europe. I think of Hulud often and hope that she and her children are receiving the care and support they so desperately need as refugees. But there are thousands more families like Hulud's, all over Europe, in desperate need of our care and support. So please join me in giving to UNHCR's appeal for the refugee crisis in Europe. Anything you can give, no matter how small, will help. I have seen the UNHCR's work firsthand, and I know that work makes a difference.
That was Cate Blanchett, the Hollywood actress, asking you to give to the UNHCR. I do so myself, and I'm not just... I do it so I can live with myself. Because we have so much, and these people have so little. So give if you can. Wanted to put that in the broadcast. Now back to the mundane politics. We're going to do a short bit right now about probably somebody that we should stop laughing about. His name is Donald Trump, ladies and gentlemen, and this show has been quite liberal in our way of laughing at Donald Trump. But in the past 2 weeks, Donald Trump has turned into something quite serious and is no longer a joke. I would go so far as to say that if you wanted a face of American fascism, look at Donald Trump. Bill, how can you say that? Bill, that's over. I don't know, fascism. No. This is a string of some of the things that Donald Trump has said in the last 2 weeks, and they stopped being funny. I was listening to them in absolute terror, actually. Not so much what he said, but how many people cheered him. Let's listen to what Donald Trump has been up to in the last 2 weeks, and we'll come back.
But I'm good at war. I've had a lot of wars of my own. I'm really good at war. I love war in a certain way, but only when we win. We never win. By the way, when was the last time we won a war? We don't win anymore. Our wars are always politically correct. We don't want to win. We don't want to this. He asked me a question about ISIS. And I say to the announcer, I don't really want to answer it. And the next day, these idiots over here say, Trump doesn't know the answer. The reason I don't want to answer, because I don't want to tell the enemy. If I win, I don't want to have to. Does that make sense? I don't want to tell them. So 2 weeks go by, and I get the question again. How would you fight ISIS, Mr. Trump, if you're president? I said, do I have to answer it? Do I have to? They said, Mr. Trump, we really think it's appropriate. Too, because I was getting killed in the press as saying I'm not, I know more about ISIS than the generals do, believe me. I said, all right, so here's what I do. I hated to do it. Oh, I hated to do it. Because I think I'm going to win. And I don't want these guys. No, I really, I don't want these guys. Because my life has been about victories, in all fairness, okay? It's been about victories. I've had a lot of victories. I'm not like a person that enjoys. You know, you have a lot of people that like to lose, you know. They like to lose. They feel comfortable losing. That's not me. I don't feel too good when I lose. But I said, I don't want to really tell you, but then I realized I had to, because I was getting killed by these people. They said, Trump doesn't have a plan for ISIS. I would bomb the shit out of them.
Are you unequivocally now ruling out a database on all Muslims?
No, not at all. I want a database for the refugees that if they come into the country, we have no idea who these people are. When the Syrian refugees are going to start pouring into this country, we don't know if they're ISIS. We don't know if it's a Trojan horse. And I definitely want a database and other checks and balances. We want to go with watch lists. We want to go with databases. And we have no choice. We have no idea who's being sent in here. This could be the great Trojan. It's probably not, but it could be the great Trojan horse of all time.
I told Yahoo News that we have to be doing things that were unthinkable a year ago. I want to get into what you had in mind. For example, do you think we should bring back enhanced interrogation like waterboarding?
We have to. I would bring it back. Yes, I would bring it.
Do I hear somebody over there? All right. Yeah, get him the hell out of here, will you, please? Get him out of here. Throw him out. Yeah, you can get him out. Yeah, get him out. Get him the hell out of here. Get him out of here. Get out. Get him out of here.
Trump was obviously talking about a Black Lives Matter activist who showed up in one of his rallies. Oh, by the way, that guy was beaten. He was kicked and punched and thrown out. Trump isn't a joke anymore, folks. And what is truly terrifying, what is absolutely terrifying, is the cheers that you hear. This abortion of a man, and I say that, that's what I mean. This man has a 17% lead in the Republican Party. We have faced this type of thing before. Torture, watch lists, surveillance, bigotry. This is fascism. And this is where the Republican Party's going. Right to fascism. And if you want to know who the person in American politics that is the best friend of ISIS, you're looking at him. His name is Donald Trump. We've suffered through Joe McCarthy. We suffered through George Wallace. And right now, having somebody like Trump literally letting go the id of the Republican Party, because these are all the people that really don't want to say the N-word. They don't want to say the N-word. And for years, it's been driving them crazy. It's been driving them crazy that they can't execute their actual base emotions of hatred and bile and bigotry for so long. And now, it's okay. They've been condoned by their candidate who is in the Republican primary and leading. And he's also the best friend of ISIS. Why do I know that? Because ISIS will tell you what their motivation and strategy is. The strategy was outlined in a 2004 manifesto called, forgive my pronunciation, Idarat at Tawahush, The Management of Savagery, a tract written for ISIS's precursor, the Iraqi branch of Al-Qaeda. Now, here are some of the axioms. diversify and widen the vexation strikes against the Crusader Zionist enemy in every place in the Islamic world, even outside of it, if possible, so as to disperse the efforts of the alliance of the enemy and thus drain it to the greatest extent possible. Well, they've done that. To be effective, attacks should be launched against soft targets. They're doing that. That cannot possibly be defended to any appreciable degree, leading to debilitating security state. That's what Trump wants. If a tourist resort that the Crusaders, that's us, patronize, is hit, all of the tourist resorts in all of the states of the world will have to be secured by the work of additional forces, which are double the ordinary amount and a huge increase of spending. Well, Bin Laden more or less managed to, along with George Bush, sink the treasury. Does Trump favor increased military expenditure? Oh, yeah. Yeah, he does. Crucially, these tactics are also designed to appeal to disaffected young who tend to rebel against authority and are eager for self-sacrifice. The aim is to motivate crowds drawn from the masses to fly to the regions where we manage, particularly the youth. For the youth of the nation are closer to the innate nature of humans. Violence. On account of their rebelliousness in them. Finally, these violent attacks should be used to draw the West as deeply and actively as possible into military conflict. Work to expose the weaknesses of America's centralized power by pushing it to abandon the media, psychological war, and the war by proxy until it fights directly. All these things are things that Trump is in favor of because he's a macho guy. He's gonna bomb the shit out of him. And he is ISIS's best friend. Domestically, his policies have come close to ethnic cleansing, because we're going to build a wall around America, and then we are going to put all the foreigners on databases, and we're going to ship every Mexican back to Mexico. Now, we've been laughing hysterically about that, the way liberals do, but I think it's about time we stopped laughing. John Kasich came out with an ad that more or less, and I've never said anything nice about John Kasich, but I'm saying it now. He hit it on the head. This is a new ad that John Kasich has come out with on the net. And it refers to a quote by someone who lived through Nazi Germany. Listen to this.
I would like anyone who is listening to consider some thoughts that I paraphrase from the words of German pastor Martin Niemöller. You might not care if Donald Trump says Muslims must register with their government because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump says he's going to round up all the Hispanic immigrants because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump says it's okay to rough up black protesters because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump wants to suppress journalists because you're not one. But think about this. If he keeps going and he actually becomes president, he might just get around to you. And you better hope that there's someone left to help you.
Kasich is right. And you know something, Thanksgiving come back. I'm have Thanksgiving here. I'm going to go back to the States. And if I hear someone talk to me about Trump, you know the Uncle Crazy? I'm through being polite. Trump's fascist. He's a fascist. And we've seen fascism have many different garbs. We've seen it, elements of fascism from George Wallace. We've seen elements of fascism from Joe McCarthy. But this guy is being taken seriously by a majority of Republicans to become the next president of the United States. That doesn't scare the shit out of you. It should. So maybe we're going to have to stop some of the fun that we have at Donald Trump's expense, because it's not funny anymore, folks. Kasich is absolutely right on this account. And what should disturb us most is the cheers that you hear in that auditorium. What the hell is happening? What the hell is happening? These were the people, these are the candidates, these were the political figures that the Republicans used to keep in a box. And they fed them and they fed them and they fed them for years. And now they own the store. I think that probably before we go to Randy and Randy's rant, what we're going to do is have a quote from somebody much wiser than me who was faced with this kind of demagoguery years ago. If you change the names, folks, it fits perfectly. We'll be right back.
We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were for the moment unpopular. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the result. There is no way for a citizen of a republic to abdicate his responsibilities. As a nation, we have come into our full inheritance at a tender age. We proclaim ourselves, as indeed we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The action have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
And now it's time for Randy's Rant. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore! Ladies and gentlemen, here I am sitting in, as I said, sunny Southern California. And my rant this week is something that's been bothering me for quite some time. And you know what? I'm not the only one that's been bothered by this. Conservatives and liberals alike. Is Ted Cruz really eligible to run for president of the United States? Now, this comes up all the time when there is anybody remotely not natural born. In fact, it's still going on with Obama, even though he was born in the state of Hawaii and actually had a Hawaiian birth certificate. But it also went on with John McCain, who was born in the Panama Canal Zone to two American parents, one of whom was a serving U.S. Naval officer, I believe. And he was declared a U.S. citizen born abroad. And there was also a special resolution passed by the Senate to anoint him, as it were, as a native-born American before he ran for president. But Ted Cruz, is Ted Cruz actually a native-born American? Now, there's no denying that he was not born in America. The only birth certificate he has is Canadian. He was born in Canada in quite some time ago, 1970. He only has a Canadian birth certificate. There is no U.S. Citizen born abroad to a U.S. parent certificate. Now, my three children were born abroad to a U.S. citizen parent, and I was able to get them a overseas U.S. citizen birth certificate, but I doubt that they would be able to run for president, though I'm pretty sure they wouldn't want to. Now, he moved to the U.S. when he was 4 years old, or his parents moved him to the U.S. and settled in Canada, and later
He became applied and became a U.S. citizen, but I don't think he was ever declared a U.S. citizen born abroad. Now, his father was Cuban. His mother was born in America, in Delaware. Now, whether she stayed in America the requisite 10 years to achieve full residence, or whether she was moved to Canada, or whether she in fact became a Canadian citizen herself, we don't know. But she may not have achieved full U.S. residency. There's no denying that Ted Cruz had achieved his full 15 years U.S. residency before becoming a U.S. citizen. That's not denied. But he only renounced his Canadian citizenship within the last 2 years. So I think he renounced it in 2013, and it became effective in 2014. So he has only not, he's only not been a Canadian for 1 year. Now, I'm not quite sure what he is now, because he doesn't have a birth certificate for the United States. So I think they're going to have to sort this out. It kind of bothers me. They sorted it out with John McCain. I think this has only really come into a problem when there were people becoming president who were not born in the United States, which are probably about the first, I don't know, at least 10 or 15 of them. But because there was no United States until, at least until the Constitution and everything in 1791. Now, okay, I've got a little clip here from the Next News Network from earlier this year. The reporter is Gary Franchi, and he looks at this very same issue. Is Ted Cruz still a Canadian, and is he eligible to run for U.S. president?
The moment I reported that Ted Cruz kicked off his presidential campaign was the moment that emails and comments began coming in. Timma said, "There is no debate. He was born in Canada to a Cuban-born Canadian dad, and his mom didn't go to Canada on official business. Both parents must be born in the United States. Fuck. Why not just elect Prince Harry and get it fucking over with, for fuck's sake?" Patriots R Us rejected the notion and defended Cruz's eligibility. "Fact is," he said, "both Barry and Cruz are legitimate to be president according to a court ruling that says only one parent has to be an American citizen." Nick Lenfant left these remarks: "Cruz is Canadian born. We already have a dictator that isn't a natural American. Look where that got us. No thanks. Don't care how great the man is. It's time Americans stand on principle. And Mrs. Cruz with the CFR? I don't think so. Give me Donald Trump." Don Worry said, "Report on this. Ted Cruz is not eligible to be president." Boom. And neither was Obama. So let's look at these simple requirements our founders set in place in Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5 of the Constitution for one to be president, and see if it lines up, if Ted Cruz lines up. The first point: one must be a natural-born citizen of the United States, a true citizen. Two, one must be at least 35 years of age. And three, one must have held U.S. residency for at least 14 years prior. Now, according to Toronto lawyer Stephen Green, he said he's a Canadian. Well, that was, of course, until he renounced his Canadian citizenship on May 14th, 2014. That's right. 1 year prior, he released his birth certificate to the Dallas Morning News, showing without a doubt he was born in Calgary, Canada, in 1970. Then, when he was 4 years old, Ted Cruz moved to Texas. So we know he is over 35 and has maintained residency here for more than 14 years. But the question stands, is he a natural-born citizen? What does natural-born citizen mean? Well, in 2011, the Congressional Research Service defined it. They said the term natural-born citizen would mean a person who is entitled to U.S. citizenship by birth or at birth by being born abroad to U.S. citizen parents. Note the CRS states parents, that is parent with an S on the end, meaning more than one U.S. citizen parent. Then just recently, the Harvard Law Review defined it with this March 11, 2015 opinion. They said, quote, someone born to a U.S. citizen parent generally becomes a U.S. citizen without regard to whether the birth takes place in Canada, the Canal Zone, or the continental United States. The HLR conveniently used the singular version of the word parent. So which one is it? Well, the U.S. State Department says, yes, a child born to both one or two parents of U.S. citizenship is all that is needed for citizenship to transfer to the child. But there are stipulations if one of the parents is not a U.S. citizen. In Ted Cruz's case, his mother would have needed to be physically present in the United States for at least 10 years prior to Ted's birth. So was she? Well, according to Cruz's own birth certificate, his mother, Eleanor Wilson, was born and raised in Wilmington, Delaware. But did she live in the U.S. for at least 10 years? That point is still unclear. So far, the only source that I could find stating that she did live in the U.S. for 10 years is Snopes.com. Yes, I know they are not the final say on this investigation, so I'm going to crowdsource this question to you. Will you help me find the answer? Was Ted Cruz's mother in the U.S. for at least 10 years prior to his birth? Answer that question and we'll prove his eligibility. Post your links to your investigation in the comment section below, and let's get to the bottom of this. For the Next News Network, I'm Gary Franchi.
Yes, and the tinfoil hats, the news and commentary we listen to, because we hate our own heads. Guys, the tinfoil hat today is me. I had this wonderful conversation that I had recorded with Randy. As you know, we do FaceTime, so we have to coordinate the time, and we did, and everything like that. And then I hit a button on a computer. Now, Randy would tell me it's still there, but I can't find it anywhere. So, trust me, it was a wonderful conversation. Let me relate it to you. when he hears this, Randy, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I screwed up. I also want to actually take this little time here to kind of say, I'm sorry if I get preachy sometimes. In the first start of the show, I think I was a bit dark. A bit. You know. And I thought I'd take a time to kind of explain and address a few of the questions that we get sometimes on the show. And it's both Randy and me, and then before that was Bill and me. But I remember somebody once saying, you're overseas, you live in another country now, you're an expat. Where the hell do you get off criticizing America? And I really want to say this honestly and from my heart. This is not criticism, and this does not come from a place that is not love. And I think that it's important. Sometimes I'm very, we did a show a couple of days ago. We're talking about Americans being dumb, dumb, dumb. You know something? America is not a dumb country. And that's why what's happening right now is very, very shocking to me. Because you got to understand something. I was brought up in Boston. My father worked at a business in Boston, and he was laid off, and he saw the change. Every time I go back there, I see it differently from the place that I was brought up in, you understand? There has been a massive change in the 20 years that I've been away. And you look overseas in absolute dismay sometimes. And it because it's something you love. You know, I'm going back to the United States. I love the United States. I miss so many things about the United States. My work brought me here. And it has been a good life here. And there are certain things that I have here that I wish deeply. I mean, I have relatives who, you know, max out their cards on health insurance. You know, a relative of mine actually had to go to Arlington Cemetery and bury his nephew. And to see America go through the things right now that you see in Donald Trump and you see in the language that's going on today is utterly, sometimes quite terrifying. So we do not criticize American policy or what's happening in the Republican Party with anything other than hopefully sometimes a little bit of a rude kind of childlike humor, but it's never from the point of hating. You can look at the amount of money I spend on plane tickets to get home. So that being said, I thought it was a good question sometimes, and I've had it before, so I thought I'd say that. Anyway, listen, we're going to call it quits for this show. This show was a bit, as I said, a bit dark, except for Randy's contribution. And Randy had a very good contribution that, unfortunately, you'll never hear. So, there you go. It's a podcast. Sorry. But we try to get these up, you know, on a regular basis. So, you know, those people who do bother to listen, and they're quite a sizable bunch. Yeah, I'm very, very, by the way, thanks for that. You know, it's lovely to have a voice on in this kind of internet world and to enjoy that as a pastime that I have enjoyed both with Bill and with Randy. So anyway, I'm going to wave goodbye to you now and take us out. I found this great song from Johnny Cash, and I want to share it with you. And until next time, this has been The Bill Show, and good night.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know.